And welcome to the Issue Is Podcast Extra. This is where we get to hang out with some of our favorite panelists and have in-depth conversations about their crazy lives. And I always love it when we can have a fellow podcaster in the house. John Thomas is here, host of the Thomas Guide podcast on KFI and also all the different iHeartRadio properties. He's on KFI as their political guide. Mm-hmm. The Thomas Partner Strategies, he's the president of that.
Yes, I run a political consulting firm. Yeah. That's my day job.
Yes, but he likes to talk, too.
You'll notice that throughout this show. Yeah, I like to talk a lot.
And a lot of his background is in Republican politics, is sort of an ad man for TV ads, digital ads, helps different candidates and companies come up with their strategies on how to manipulate the media and voters and get their way.
Wow. Manipulate is not exactly the word I'd use. I'd say communicate.
Communicate. Yeah. I'm kidding. With manipulate. So we thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
And we appreciate all your time and insight, and thank you for doing our TV show as well. And I think it's interesting to learn more about you. And since this is kind of a political show, do you remember when you first were interested in politics, or what got you interested in politics in the first place?
I remember it verbatim, yes. I read the entire Ken Starr report on Bill Clinton, and at the time, I want to say I was about 12 years old. And for whatever reason, maybe it was the sex appeal, the risque nature of it.
Yeah.
I was sucked into watching the entire impeachment process back then. Interesting, we've kind of come full circle to today. But it turned out at the time that the House impeachment manager, Jim Rogan, was my congressman in Glendale, where I lived. And my parents explained to me that as public opinion began shifting away from impeachment against the Republicans, that even Republicans in the House were turning against the impeachment efforts, yet Jim Rogan, the congressman, was determined as the House impeachment manager to impeach this president. And my parents explained that here's a guy who was really one of the biggest rising stars in the Republican Party and was probably going to lose his reelection effort over this because the Clintons had targeted this district and impeachment wasn't popular in his district anymore. Yet Jim felt that because it was the right thing to do, because he felt this president lied under oath, which he did, that he needed to pursue it, even if it meant ending his entire life's work. And he knew it would. He still felt that it was the right thing to do. So what did I do? I had my mom drop me off from school after school right at the campaign office. I had saved about $500, which for a 12-year-old kid is a lot of money. And I wanted to make a contribution saying, here, I'd like to give this to the congressman to support him, and I'd like to be a volunteer. Long story short, I worked my way up the chain, was there every single day after school, on weekends, and I just got bit by the bug, Alex. I have not missed a cycle since.
So you were like an Alex B. Keaton.
Yeah. I was a geek. I loved it. And my favorite thing to do when I was 12 and 13 years old working on campaign after campaign was honestly to call Democrats and have them yell at me on the phones and try to persuade them. I don't know if that's a good thing, a bad thing, but it was just something I liked. And as the So I knew this was something I wanted to do as a profession, even at that young age. And then every move I made besides just working in the campaign world, my undergraduate degree at SMU was in advertising and crisis management. My master's at Pepperdine was in public policy. And it was all from an understanding of how do I become the best storyteller and strategist I possibly can be.
Why, as a 12-year-old, did you think that Bill Clinton should be impeached?
Well, that's a good question. One, he lied under oath. That's a big deal. Two, you know, I looked at him as he was degrading the office by having sexual relations. Let's not go into what he did with cigars under the Resolute desk. But just to me, that felt like it was just dramatically beneath the dignity of what goes on inside that office.
How do you think that President Trump is respecting the dignity of the office?
Well, I don't think he's getting blowjobs. Like, we could say that on a podcast.
Whatever.
But I don't think he's doing
that we know of.
That we know of.
Yeah.
Inside the Oval Office. Look, I think Trump's style is completely different than we've ever seen. But I actually don't think he's beneath the dignity in the same way. And also, look, there have been countless books written about actually a client of ours. He's running for Congress in California's 7th District, Buzz Patterson. He was the guy who carried the nuclear football under Bill Clinton. And he's written countless books, one called Dereliction of Duty, about how the Clintons had such a disdain for the military that they wouldn't even allow them to wear the uniform. Hillary changed the policy that the officers were not allowed to wear their uniforms on the White House premise. And the reason they wear the uniforms is in case of an emergency, you can spot the military members. That's why. But the Clintons so despised the military, according to Buzz, that she would not let them wear – they had to wear suits. They were not allowed – so all of those things – made an impression, and of course my parents are Republicans too, so that, you know, I was probably being spun one way, but that's what led me to that point.
What happened to the congressman that you were working for?
Lost.
Yeah.
He still to date was that is the most expensive race for Congress in US history, excluding self-funders. Still to date. Jim Rogan is a dear friend of mine. I became a mentor after that. And he's now a Superior Court judge in Orange County and has been for a number of years. He was supposed to – he ended up heading up the patent office for a short time after he lost his congressional race. And then he was supposed to be appointed to, I believe, the California Supreme Court. But Boxer was blocking him, and he never could get confirmed. So he – anyway, there he is.
So is that what – was that the Adam Schiff race?
Correct.
Adam Schiff beat him, and right. now he's at the heart of the impeachment
and
debate.
Which is really fascinating. I'm actually running a client named Eric Early against Adam Schiff to bring it full circle. But it is fascinating to look at – Adam is keenly aware of the dangers of going full impeachment and what it can mean. Now, the difference in Adam's case is – registration in that district has tilted heavily Democrat. So while impeachment may or may not overwhelmingly be popular in that district, he has party registration on his side. Jim, at that point when he ran, it was a toss-up in terms of registration.
So you've got a guy who's running against Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff is on TV probably more than just about any other Democrat
I'd
in
say,
the country,
you know,
right?
Next to Barack Obama, he's probably one of the top, right? Maybe Barack AOC.
Barack Obama's not on TV very much anymore.
Maybe AOC gets a little more coverage.
So, I mean, he gets a ton of attention.
Sure.
He's in a district that's heavily Democratic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's really become an icon for many on the left.
He has, yeah.
How do you beat somebody like that? What's your strategy? What goes through your mind?
Well, I can't unveil all our cards, but essentially the frame of the race, I think, is this. Number one, it's going to be immensely expensive because Adam is a household name. My client is relatively unknown. So just to get at parity with name recognition in this LA media market, it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars. But essentially the frame is while Adam has been chasing cameras to feather his own nest, some say to run for U.S. Senate, we'll see, but by the way, wasted tens of millions of taxpayer dollars in this process of Russia collusion and all these things that have proven to be false, look at on a local level what's happening in his district. And that's the wedge, is homelessness is skyrocketing, Alex. Crime, you just pick – it's – businesses are fleeing. You start attacking him on the things that he's not doing because he wants to be on camera all the time.
And that's sort of how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ended up winning, right?
Yes.
In a primary.
You take your district for granted.
Yeah.
You always have to spend time in your district. Adam, if you look at his public events calendar, he's almost always in D.C. He's not in the district a whole lot. He thinks he's safe. So there are instances where you can bounce an incumbent like this. Eric, my client's principal challenge, besides raising gobs of cash even to communicate, is if he can have the voters walk into the voting booth for that particular race asking themselves, has Adam Schiff helped made a measurable difference on an issue like homelessness? We win. If they walk into the voting booth and say, do I like Donald Trump or not, then we probably don't win.
Yeah, and you're running, in, of course, when President
Trump
is
on the
ballot.
I can cite countless examples where there's been a split ticket vote. I've seen it.
Yeah.
It's just so expensive and hard, but maybe it'll be done.
So what was your first campaign that you worked on? Obviously, you did this one as a 12-year-old, but like you worked on as a professional. When who was the first one that gave you a shot?
Gosh, I mean, I've worked on hundreds of races. I'd say in a meaningful way that would matter to the California audience would probably be Steve Cooley's. He was the old DA.
LA County.
Yeah, LA County, three-termed district attorney. Got him reelected. You know, it's a countywide race. It was at a time when, you know, Democrats were comfortably in the majority. And so he was a conservative Republican that got elected and reelected over and over. So I think that was a meaningful moment for me. The other big, I'd say, like local breakout race I had that caused me from going just – I started out as a when I was a full-time professional as a campaign manager where I just did everything from – but I only had a one campaign at a time. And then what happened is I had a breakout race in 2009 where I won a race we shouldn't have won. And then all of a sudden my phone started ringing all over California and other states to hire me. And then at that point it made sense to start a consulting firm where we don't sit in an office. You know, campaigns like war, Alex, a lot of times there's nothing to do meaningfully from a – campaign manager, the candidate has to do stuff. But then there are moments where it needs everything you've got. And if you can get hired by a bunch of people, you can make a lot more money. And quite frankly, my strategic mind can be a better use working on 10 or 20 races at once than one for 2 years at a time. So I did this LA City Attorney's race. A guy named Carmen Trutanich was running against Jack Weiss at the time, was the LA City Council member. He was Antonio Villaraigosa's choice, well-known Democrat. Anyway, We took Carmen from obscurity, had never even run for dog catcher, and beat Jack Weiss. It was like – LA Times called it the biggest upset in 40 years. In fact, the LA Times after that race did a front page profile piece on me, which I was a little wary about because typically when they do profiles as Republicans, it might not go the way you want it to go. But it was great because the Times had seen me up close and personal and seen what I did in that race, and they dubbed me Billy the Kid of Political Battles, which was like the best thing that they could have given me. So that actually gave me national press exposure that then even grew my firm even bigger than that.
So a lot of your clients are in California. Uh-huh. You're a Republican in California, which is not that easy these days.
No, it's not at all.
You know, the Democrats have supermajorities in both the Assembly and the Senate. There's only 7 out of 54 congressional members that are Republican. Every statewide office holder is a Democrat. Mm-hmm. What are Republicans doing wrong? What can they do differently?
Well, the party has a brand issue. That's not really my responsibility. I've got a lot of thoughts on it, but my job
What should the brand be?
Well, right now it's upside down in California. I think the challenge is we've lost the control in the sense of I don't think that your average voter in California understands that the idea that some of the policies coming out of Sacramento are bad for your public safety. I don't think they fully understand that. I don't think they understand this insatiable desire to tax and regulate because the voters are really not tuned into what goes on in Sacramento. They see every cycle when ballot props come down and they see all these ads for puppies and kittens. It all sounds wonderful. But then they kind of tune out on the reality. And you can see it. Sometimes they have buyer's remorse, you know, on high-speed rail and other things. But I just don't think the Republicans have done a good job of framing that they're in their best interest. And then, of course, shifting demographics is a problem. You know, you've got an influx of younger voters, minorities that typically vote Democrat anyway. So that's a problem for the brand. And then you've got this. Well, let's say this. Both brands, actually, the R's and the D's in California, have a problem. And you can see that by the growing no party preference category. If you look at the trend lines, NPP will eventually eclipse both parties. It's just there's a lot more Democrats than Republicans, so they can buy themselves some more time in that process. But anyway, how does a Republican get elected? The answer is strategically target the seats you can win. You can't play in every district. You shouldn't try to play in every district. Last cycle in the midterms in 18, we bounced we defeated a 20-year incumbent district attorney. We were the only prominent Republican to win in Orange County period because everybody else got wiped out. Mm-hmm. And how do we do it? We localized the race and we talked about things like homelessness. We took the issue of guns and we owned it in the sense of we found ways to talk about guns that actually won with NPPs and Dems, talking about getting guns out of classrooms and prioritizing school safety, that those are some of my client's priorities, and that he had made a meaningful difference on homelessness when he cleaned up the Santa Ana riverbed. Todd Spitzer was a county supervisor before DA. So we did that. And then some other – there's some just strategic things. I don't want to geek out too much, but using advanced analytics is a huge technique that we use that's used at the presidential level but not used much down ticket. I don't know why.
What does that mean for most people?
Okay.
That may not know.
That's where
– break it down.
Thank
simply.
You. I can feel my head getting a little swelling with geek. Essentially, what we're able to do, your standard political poll has a – it talks to 300 or 400 people in a given congressional district, whatever, and then we're able to make very good assumptions about what voters think about big messages, or make good assumptions about the broader electorate. But I can't tell you what Alex Michelson thinks about Donald Trump or about your potential district attorney candidate or a particular issue. I can say, well, white. You know, no party preference voter, age, 18 to 35 might think that these three issues are a good thing.
Right.
But I can't tell you, Alex. Now what we're able to do is put together these where the sample is about 20,000 to 50,000 people. And then we overlay commercial data and then we have these predictive models on top of it. And what we're able to do is come up with a predictive model on a voter by voter level. So I'm able to tell you exactly what, even if I haven't talked to you, Alex, I can tell you what you think about Donald Trump. I can tell you what you think about the key issues. I can tell you if I buy consumer data. So I can tell you if you shop at Ralph's, I can tell you that you may have switched from Charmin to generic.
And really?
Yes, I can tell that. And then I can tell that you might be susceptible to moving on an economic message more than some other message.
So because I don't want a toilet paper.
Well, there's
I'm shifting on
that,
something
that,
else.
That could
you
literally,
really could say yeah, you really yes. could like pick some yes. random person you know what mm-hmm. they were buying in the store.
Yep. And so that's
because
one,
they use their Vons card mm-hmm. or their Ralph's
and we
card.
We can buy that data. Yeah, it's scary. I mean, the things I know, and so here, but it gets even crazier than that. So then the question is, when I know who you are, I can know if you are persuadable or not. There's a segment of the electorate in every election that will never vote for my client, no matter what, no matter how, what we told them. So I can take them out of my persuasion universe so we become at least 30% more efficient, just not wasting our money. Mm. And then I'm able to track Alex because I can over – again, this is geeky. But I can take that data. I can now tether your voter information to your IP address at your home. And then the second you log in with your cell phone on your Wi-Fi or your tablet or your laptop, now I can follow you and harass you with digital ads. And I know exactly how many times you've seen my ad. And I know exactly how many times you've clicked it. So I can see if I'm moving you, and then we can refresh these analytics models, and we know. I mean, in general, the races I run that are well-funded, I know whether or not I'm going to win 4 weeks out. I mean, I know by exactly how much.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's
so
scary.
So it's bringing – it's bringing some of the – but the thing is we don't sit around going, oh, well –
And this is a congressional race. You
or
think
a
about
district
what's
attorney's race.
What's happening at the presidential
level.
Oh, you
don't even – I mean, it's insane, the level of sophistication. For instance, we – it's a whole other podcast into itself. But the level of A-B testing that we get to do before we ever deploy a mail piece or a TV ad is I can run those. I can run – I'll give you an example. When I cut a television ad, I typically will cut like 5 to 10 different versions of the same one message. So I know the message you need to hear. But what I don't know is do you like me in a red tie or a blue tie? Do you like it with an ominous narrator or a gentle female narrator? And I can test 5 to 10 different sets of creative a couple weeks in advance before I go up. And I know which gets the best click-through rates, which has people watch it to completion before they click the skip. So then I get the best bang for my buck when I do go up on television.
So for that, and then so then maybe you do one on an NFL football game and another one on the Ellen show and you different kinds of strategies for that.
Yeah.
Is that what
you're
doing?
That's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
The Trump campaign actually is really sophisticated this cycle, much more. In 16, Alex, I mean, it was a circus. They had no idea what they were doing. And part of the problem was I don't think Trump believed that even until election night that he was going to win. But part of the problem was they couldn't get people like me to even work with the Trump campaign because at that time he was considered a loser, he's toxic. So all of the people that could bring best practices weren't working with Trump at that time. This time it's completely differently. He is running, or his team is running, a completely streamlined operation. And what they're doing, we go on for days about this, but here's one of the most critical things that they're doing. They know exactly which states are going to decide this election. They may not know the one state, but they know the handful that it will be.
Which are?
Wisconsin, Florida, Michigan, the list goes, Ohio. Yeah. And so what they're doing is they are spending doing digital ads right now, both banners and video. They are spending meaningful amounts of money on persuasion ads in those states now. Never been done this far early. Now, why does it even matter? Because in my business, you probably heard the phrase, it's all about framing the debate. The person or the candidate who frames the debate on their terms first almost always wins. And so what Trump and his organization is doing in those states, they are framing the conversation about the lens of which the voters should view this upcoming election before the Democrats even can see their way out of a primary.
Well, and is that why, in your view, he's trying to make Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the face of the party and he's talking about socialism so much?
That's
and
exactly.
It's because he's trying to, before you even get a nominee, make the nominee somebody that people in those states would find unappealing.
That's exactly it. And essentially they're going to the part 2.0 of that conversation is that all Democrats, whether it's the nominee or a House member, is part of the squad, and that the squad represents socialism and reduced economic freedom.
And healthcare for undocumented immigrants.
I mean, the list. And, so what you do
and
is
invasion
you,
yeah, and you, infestation.
You look at that broad frame and then everything else fits right into it.
So and that would be the people that think that the president's playing, you know, chess and other people are playing checkers kind of thing. So do you think, I mean, and I know you're biased, but do you think that right now President Trump is the front runner?
Yeah, I'd say he has a 60% shot at it. I mean, look, the great thing about elections is anything can still happen. The president himself is a wild card. I mean, who knows what this guy's going to say? The campaign, I think, is much more disciplined than it was in 16. But Trump is still Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, world events. If the stock market tanks and the economy dips, he doesn't have that fundamental argument anymore. I mean, this president is not going to become popular overnight. So it's really he's got his fundamental his policies have to carry the day, and then he has to burn down the Democratic nominee. But I would give him better than even odds.
And some would argue burn down the country in the process.
I don't know that I would make that argument. I mean, I think for him to be tough on socialism is a healthy thing. I don't see that. And look, this is not a game of beanbag, okay? This is a full contact sport. It always has been. You know, we used to, back in our political contests a few hundred years ago, we would shoot our political opponents with guns.
Like,
in a sense, it's become more civil. Where it's gotten worse is it's become more intrusive because you can't just flip off the TV anymore.
So if you were playing the issue is drinking game, you can now take a shot for the Aaron Burr reference that we just got.
Thanks.
Expecting that. Little Hamilton in there. So of all the people on the Democrats are putting up right now, who is the most electable and who's the least electable?
Oh, my gosh. That is a great question. I would say Joe Biden is probably the most electable if he could make his way through a primary. I'm not sure Biden could beat Trump. I'm not sure because he has a host of challenges. And remember, for anybody to get through this primary process, they're going to have to tack further to the left than where they are. They're just going to. So I'm not even sure of Biden if he makes it out that he can't. I don't know that he may have. He's still going to be likable. But it's going to take more than that. I think Biden can't make as good of an economic argument because he has a record that Trump can. But I'd say Biden if he can make it. But I don't think he'll be the nominee. There's two people I'm watching as this process evolves that I think are most likely to win the nomination.
Let me guess who you're going to say. You're going to say Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris? Or maybe Mayor Pete?
You got 50% right.
Okay.
I'm going to say Elizabeth Warren and Tom Steyer.
Tom Steyer?
Yeah. You heard it here first. So Elizabeth Warren, from the sense of, I think when I've looked at, and I've personally done a ton of national polling, and when you ask Democrats the profile of the kind of person they want, they look like Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris. It's a fighter, female, with a record of accomplishment, great if they're minority too. So the profile of Elizabeth Warren works out great. I think her message of this populist message is a winner. She's a I think she's running, of all the people in the field, she's running the most textbook campaign at almost every level. She's from a field operation to a messaging. Now, the Pocahontas stuff was a big mistake. She had a goof. I think it's going to hurt her in a general more than in a primary. But she's hitting her marks. At every debate, I watch the debate, I don't go, wow, she won that debate. But she doesn't have to. She just has to play it steady.
Right.
The other person I'm watching is Tom Steyer. Because he's coming in at a point. You're already seeing him. He's popped up in some polls upwards of 6% in just a couple weeks.
Which poll's that?
I think the Harris-Rasmussen poll, just got it there. What he's doing right now is he's advertising in the first early four states. This is a guy, remember, who spent almost $150 million in the midterms of his own dollars. And right. He wasn't even on the ballot. Yeah. What do you think he'll do when he's on the ballot? So the question is, can he buy himself his way onto that debate stage? I think he will. And I think he's anti-Trump without being considered to be crazy. He was the OG. I told you we should have impeached this a-hole. Now, you know, I was leading the way. I've got the guts to do it. And he's leading on an issue of climate change, which is the red meat issue in a Democratic primary.
But you think that the Democratic Party, which is wanting to nominate a white billionaire?
Well, look, I think he can make an argument that it takes one to beat one. But more than that, I think that the fact that he's going to have the capital in a fractured field to drown out those early states. Alex, he doesn't have to come in first place in Iowa. He has to come in third.
Yeah.
If he comes in third, he could – remember, when everybody else starts dropping out, mostly because – they don't have the money. Tom can keep going. If he can survive the first few states, I think he's got a reasonable path. And then let's say Biden implodes or somebody, you know, just implodes. He can move right into their lane. I'm not saying he'll be the nominee, but I actually think he has a seriously real path. The other thing is an old colleague of mine, a Democratic ad maker named Mark Putnam. I think he's the best ad maker in the country. He's done every emotional tearjerker Dem ad you've ever seen. Mark's probably done. Was started out with Biden, quit the campaign because he felt that Biden just didn't understand messaging and their campaign was old and stodgy. And he just signed on board to Tom Steyer. That tells me that Tom, number one, Mark, the consultant, is not going to go anywhere unless he has hard guarantees that he's going to make loads of money. And I mean, so that means that Steyer's probably signed guarantees that he will spend over $100 million.
Wow.
So if he's
willing to spend over $100 million.
If he's willing to deploy that level of capital,
yeah,
we'll see.
Well, it'll be tough for Tom Steyer to have a better moment than his intro video because the first 4 seconds of that was me.
I pointed that out.
You did. You were the first person that pointed that out to me.
I recognized your voice yeah. You know, a mile away.
I was shocked that the Steyer campaign launched, not with Tom Steyer's voice, but with my voice.
That was great.
So what do you make of Mayor Pete?
You know, I think he's a really smart politician. I think he has no path forward. He'll stay alive for a while because he's got a lot of money. But I see his appeal. But when you look at what the polling shows, he has appeal mostly to college-plus educated whites that make over $150,000 a year, especially if they live on the coast. He's off the charts. Wow, he's so smart, and oh, he's gay. You know, like you feel good about yourself. But his support dramatically falls off, even with white folks, once you get under certain income thresholds. So he has to solve that, although I think he can because he's very charismatic. His fundamental problem is there is a law of gravity in a Democratic primary, Alex. That is, if you can't carry a fair share of African Americans, there is no path. he is polling consistently at 0 to 1% in that block.
Yeah.
Now, why is that? I've got two theories, and this is just theories. I haven't done focus grouping on it. I don't have a client in this hunt. One is you get – especially the southern states, African-Americans are deeply religious, and I think that the gay issue that Mayor Pete was leading off with initially, I think it's just a killer there. But I think it's more than that. I think it's that Mayor Pete looks like – a middle management executive from a Bain consulting firm that talks above you. He sounds so smart. And that's why you love him if you also have a college degree and you like listening to professors. But if you're an average person, right. He sounds like he's talking above you. He's not talking to you.
Yeah. That's why Bill Clinton was so effective, right?
Right.
That really smart, absolutely. But could talk to people. And why President Trump is so effective, because people understand the way he talks.
Well, yeah.
Although Obama kind of did that a little bit, right?
You mean talked above you?
Yeah.
Yes. But he had the identity that lined up with him. He was black.
Yeah.
So essentially what's happening, I've talked about this on my podcast, which is Mayor Pete has the exact reverse problem Barack Obama. Barack Obama started with a base of he knew that African-American supporters were going to come with him when the time came. What he had to do was convince college-educated whites to come with him. He had to make that argument. So when he ran a great campaign and won Iowa and then came up, the rest of the country went, oh, my God, who is this guy? And then he was able to get that other part of the coalition. Mayor Pete is reverse. And I don't know if it can be done.
And on the black voters issue, the Quinnipiac poll that came out this week showed Joe Biden is leading all of them at 47%, Kamala Harris at 1%, mm-hmm. Cory Booker not even measuring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you make of that? Well, what do you make of those two?
Well, I think it's a lot of the afterglow of Barack Obama that's on Joe Biden right now. But this is one of the reasons I think Biden's path gets a lot harder, because there is no way on this earth that Kamala remains in single digits with African-American votes, or Cory does. Kamala and Cory's problem right now is that they have low name recognition. That people really don't – I mean, us insiders that watch this stuff every day do. But your average voter hasn't tuned into who Cory or Kamala really are yet. And the debates aren't likely to change that much until the field really narrows. It's the ad wars that are going to change that when you lift it up. So Kamala and Cory both have money. They're going to advertise. And you're telling me – I don't – maybe they don't eclipse Biden with their share of the African-American vote, but they can speak to that community with such authenticity that Biden can't, especially with his past votes. So I think as Kamala and Cory grow, which they will in that share, they pull directly from Biden.
And who has a better shot, Kamala or Cory?
Of getting the nomination?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a good question. You know, I honestly don't know. I think Cory is a better politician, a smarter politician than Kamala. I think Cory is a better retail politician, but I think the media and kind of the coastal elites, I hate to use the right-wing term, but the coastal liberals like falling in love with Kamala more because she's this biracial, tough prosecutor. So the answer is I don't know. I think what we learned in the last debate was that Kamala can throw a punch but not take one. Now, can she learn to fix that? Maybe. She's at a disadvantage in the sense of California politics, especially when you run statewide, it's not a retail politics game.
Mm-mm.
In fact, Alex, it's really pretty basic, especially if you're a Democrat. Don't make a mistake. Raise lots of money. Hire the right consultant. Go up on TV. Say the right things. By the way, and you can say many takes of it so your ad maker can cut it right. That's the name of the game.
And a lot of them don't do that many interviews.
Right, because they don't have to, because they don't want guys like you asking them tough questions that'll throw them off. So, yeah. But that's not how you win in New Hampshire. Yes, the ad wars are critical, but the retail element matters. And by the way, you can't avoid reporters. And you say something wrong to a reporter, and then all of a sudden you've got $10 million of outside PACs cramming that soundbite down every voter's throat. So I don't know that Kamala is going to be able to adapt fast enough.
Yeah,
but we'll see.
And Cory Booker dealt with the New York media market, which is a little different.
He did. I mean, yeah. You watched him at that last debate. Yeah. He's skilled.
Yeah,
he's very skilled.
All right. So as we wrap up, I want to do some of with our guests on the TV version. I want to start doing it in the podcast.
Oh, all right.
Just some of our personal issues.
Oh, boy.
Which is real quick, rapid fire, fun questions
okay.
of you. I forgot my card, so I'm just going to do them from memory.
All right.
First one. Favorite food.
Favorite food, ice cream.
Favorite book.
Atlas Shrugged.
Okay.
Surprise.
There's a conservative answer. And Rand.
It's true.
Favorite movie?
Oh. That is a good question. I'll tell you the genre.
Okay.
I like rom-coms.
Rom-coms. Mm-hmm. All right. Favorite TV show?
Sopranos.
Good one. Favorite comedian?
Oh, gosh, I have such a long list. You know, I wouldn't have said this until maybe a couple months ago, but I've been binge-watching Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and I have a much deeper appreciation for Seinfeld after that.
He is great. Mm-hmm. Favorite band or musician?
Justin Timberlake.
Really?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You're
not just because we share the same initials.
And you're looking to bring Sexy back?
No, I'm not there yet.
Already brought it back.
No, but I really am a big fan.
And your role model?
Oh, I'd say my father.
Why is that?
First of all, he's a great dad to me growing up, always there and everything. But he taught me to really have a clear sense of a moral direction, to always work hard and do the right thing even when people aren't watching. It was really, I saw him tested all throughout my life, and it's really an admirable trait.
Well, that's a nice place to end. John Thomas, thank you
Thanks.
So much for doing this.
It's
and
my
thank you for your insight. I learned a lot. That was
oh,
really,
well,
really
I hope
smart.
I didn't geek out.
That
but,
was very high level.
Much.
I think if people are listening to this, they're probably looking to geek out a little
okay.
bit. So I appreciate that, and I think our audience does too. Thank you so much for listening to the Issue Is podcast. We encourage you to listen to the other podcast we are also posting this week, which is a discussion about all of this stuff with John and Areva Martin and Stuttering John Melendez, and that also features our conversation with the governor of California, Gavin Newsom. That's something else to download. Please subscribe to the Issue Is podcast. Please subscribe to the Thomas Guide podcast as well, and listen to both of us each week. That's all for now. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening.